Welcome to the First Things podcast. In this episode, we'll look at new polling data that help us judge whether the warmth and charisma of Pope Francis are inspiring American Catholics to more frequent participation in the sacraments, the Francis effect, for good or ill. Then, everybody's been talking about Hamilton, so we will too. We'll have a civilized debate about whether the biggest thing on Broadway is a good thing or a bad thing for America. We'll wrap it up with a rap about guns and ships. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. Last week, Georgetown University's Center for Applied Research for the Apostolate released new survey findings on the sacramental participation of Catholics in America, on how often they're going to Mass and confession. There's been some movement in the last 8 years, especially among the millennial cohort. You might be surprised by the numbers, or you might not. It depends on whether you've been expecting a Francis effect. Haven't we all been? How could a pope be so radiantly charismatic and not cause a second spring in the global church? It's possible that Francis's charisma may not always redound in an uncomplicated way to the benefit of the institution he leads. Here to discuss Francis and his effects are First Things editor Rusty Reno and literary editor Matthew Schmitz. Matthew has written an opinion piece on this topic, which we expect to link soon at firstthings.com. Matthew, start with the Francis effect. What has been predicted by way of a revival of the church during the Francis pontificate?
You know, people have hoped that Francis's, friendly demeanor, his, greater latitude on moral and especially sexual questions will help bring Catholics back into the fold. Now, Rome wasn't built in a day, and one man can't reverse the church's direction overnight. So, part of the expected Francis effect, has to happen over time with the appointment of new bishops, new men coming out of seminary, all of this. But still, there's been immense hope attached to the mere powers of publicity, and especially to documents like Amoris Laetitia, which muddles the waters on communion for the divorced and remarried. This winter, Austin Ivory, who wrote the best biography of Pope Francis, said that if Amoris Laetitia succeeds, we'll see a return to parishes on a massive scale. Now, we haven't seen that. In the immediate wake of the document, we're already getting in figures that show not only is there no massive return to the parishes, but we're holding steady or getting worse. So in 2008, we saw that 23% of American Catholics attended Mass each week. 8 years later, in our most recent figures, we see that weekly Mass attendance has held steady or even marginally declined. It's only at 22%. The New York Times, also has looked at this. They found that while 13% of American Catholics attended Mass more frequently in the last 2 years, 12% are attending it less frequently, and for the remaining 74%, they say they've held steady. Now, among millennial Catholics, these people that are supposed to be especially and wildly attached to Francis, we actually see a loss of ritual participation. Millennials blag older Catholics and baby boomer Catholics in all forms of religious participation, with one exception, some kind of Lenten observance. This has been popular among younger Catholics. They like giving up things, and they've done that at higher rates than older Catholics. But they're now dropping that practice under Francis. Their rates of doing that are much lower than they were. So in 2008, 50% of millennials received ashes on Ash Wednesday, and 46% made some sacrifice beyond abstaining from meat on Fridays. This year, only 41% received ashes, and 36% made that extra sacrifice. It seems that despite all of Francis' popularity, young people are actually drifting away from the Catholic faith.
When I was in college, I always used to get so annoyed with Catholics who would show up to campus Mass only on Ash Wednesday. It seems to me so clear that they viewed it as a kind of Catholic identity badge.
I don't mind that.
Because they don't come back. after that.
Well,
you know, and they might give something
so
up
this,
for Lent.
This is where we see the problem with the kind of rationalization of the church and the loss of all of these, you know, the ceremonies and weird things and the replacement of them with an insistence on, you know, enlightened weekly mass attendance and nothing more or less. You know, Francis, when he was leading the church in Buenos Aires, you know, put a big stress on these religious processions and things like that. And you know, this appealed more to the kind of peasant Catholic population. So I don't mind the kind of people who go for the imposition of ashes and really for nothing else. But the church calendar is so thinned out now that that doesn't give you a lot to go on. If you like the kind of weird fun things in Catholicism, there's not that much weird fun stuff anymore. You know, Robert Wilkins written about this for us. The church as a culture, that's gone.
They're certainly drifting away from the sort of forms and outward observances of the Catholic faith, right? And this seems fairly consistent with Francis's rhetoric about what it is to be a decent Catholic, a decent Christian, a decent person. So could we talk about that a little bit? Francis's rhetoric on this point and how it sort of contributes to the specific kind of prestige that he's consolidating.
He's often attacks the institutional church as dead, rigid, purely legalistic. And I think he feeds into a sentiment, perhaps unwittingly, that will distinguish between being religious and being spiritual. It's, you know, one often hears people say, well, you know, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And so Francis might, with his rhetoric of the interior being having priority over the outward observance, he might be contributing to that trend in ways that he doesn't recognize.
Yeah, I think of the image of him pulling apart the hands of a young choir boy who and saying to him, you know, are your hands glued together? You know, his kind of, and you know, he wants to breathe, you know, the spirit into the bones of faith. You know, that's what he wants. He urges people in his homilies to go to Mass, to go to confession, absolutely. But Francis's anti-ritualistic rhetoric, you know, as Rusty is suggesting, I think goes along with and maybe even encourages this notion that we can be good people and maybe even good Christians without any kind of ritual participation.
Yeah, I mean, so if I'm paying close attention to this Pope and he's telling me that things that I had regarded as, you know, fairly conventional and good aspects of Catholic piety, like praying a lot of rosaries and thinking that that's a good thing to do, you know, that's the sort of thing that Francis seems to censure as Pelagianism or works righteousness. Also distinctive stances that Catholics have over the decades taken on political issues. To take those stances is to be a Pharisee in a lot of Francis's rhetoric. So if I'm listening to that, and I'm thinking, if I'm a disaffected Catholic wondering, should or should I not go back to church? What I'm thinking is, well, the forms of faith are not important. The people I'm going to meet in the pews are awful. The priest in confession is just going to be vindictive to me. Why would I ever sign up for that? So you can see how maybe it makes a lot of sense that the Francis effect is not one that generates increased participation in the sacrament.
No, it fits with his way of talking fits with my experience with Jesuits when I taught for 20 years at Creighton University in Nebraska. And that is that they take for granted the legitimacy and importance of the institutional church and then fight against a kind of shallowness and urge people to have a more intentional, deeper participation in the sacramental life of the church. And I would fight with them over their rhetoric when I was a teacher there, saying, don't you realize that the students don't even have any engagement with the institutional church and that you're trying to get them to move to stage two and they're not even at stage one?
Yeah, it's a fairly elite take on the Catholic faith, right? It presupposes a high level of, you know, adequacy in the person's spiritual life,
right.
You know, and then you start shedding the forms and you really become a virtuoso. But that just seems, that's not a good fit with the kind of spiritual challenges.
The people who want to see a Francis effect and have thought that they will see it, think that the popularity of the Pope will translate to an increased engagement with the faith. The basic reason why I don't think that will happen, and my explanation for why it hasn't yet happened, is that Francis's popularity exists independent of, and in many ways at the expense of, the institutional church. You know, his anti-institutional rhetoric, the way he seems to criticize Catholic rites, Catholic modes of public participation, you know, this is what has led to so much good press for him. So if I love Francis, it's not clear to me why I would love this Catholic faith, because, you know, the thing that I would love about him is the way that he, you know, bashes these old, hidebound, nasty, ritualistic Catholics, you know, people like you, Julia.
I think that this is absolutely the wrong approach to millennials. That I think that the whole interiority move has been around for two generations. We look at, I think millennials are living in a very fluid world, very little of permanence. And so what do? They get tattooed. They want these permanent markings. There's a kind of way in which tattooing, you know, and outward ritual are actually cut from the same cloth. It's the same kind of outward sign of something, you know, that they, you know, the inward's not enough. There has to be something outward. Mm. And so I would say that the most successful approach to millennials is a highly ritualistic form of worship, as much incense as possible, foreign language, you know, Latin, you know,
whatever,
archaic, something
Esperanto,
something that's not the everyday. And so I think the Pope is really reflects a very, very much older problem, which was
a baby boomer problem
indeed, and that the millennial problem is no solid place to stand. That the more rich, and so it's interesting that the stats are higher level of sacrifice for Lent. That just fits with my theory that
absolutely
the millennials want something tangible for faith, not just the ephemeral interior world.
So they do show up for ashes on Ash Wednesday, and maybe there is, contrary to my complaint, maybe there is something real that's going on there. That's a sort of millennial expression of
you get your temporary tattoo.
Yeah, your temporary tattoo. And so if the church calendar were constructed still in such a way that there's more of that coming in the rest of the liturgical year, that would be something maybe we could build on. Unfortunately, that's not the kind of Catholicism that we live in right
now.
Well,
because I live in New York and I have leisure time, I was able to go to Candle Mass this year, and all these people brought their candles, you know.
Where?
It was at Holy Innocence in Hell's Kitchen. Hell's Kitchen with a gateway to heaven. And, you know, people brought up their candles to be blessed, and, you know, during the Mass, whenever it happened, they went over there and just flinging water all over these candles and saying the prayers, and there's incense everywhere. And, yeah, there were people young and old, but the church was packed, and, you know, very few Catholics have the opportunity to see something like that, but I'm sure those kinds of things, where you can go get your candles blessed and you can take them away and you can light them up and smells and bells galore. I agree with Rusty. That's evangelism now. Yeah.
We're so overwhelmed by the horizontal world where everything we're being marketed to 24/7. Our work-life boundaries are increasingly blurred. And I think that the more the church is clearly distinct from the everyday of society, the more powerful its allure will be, because people want some relief from just this homogenous web that's got them, the iron cage, as Weber called it.
Billed as an American musical, Broadway's Hamilton tells the story of our first Secretary of the Treasury, Prior to his new fame on the Great White Way, Alexander Hamilton had been perhaps our least regarded founding father. He never did get to be president. He doesn't have a monument on the National Mall. And this year he barely escaped being expunged from the $10 bill. The musical opened just in time to save him from that indignity. It has made some other conquests as well. 11 Tonys, a Grammy, and a Pulitzer, and a MacArthur Genius Grant for creator and star Lin-Manuel Miranda. Michelle Obama calls Hamilton the best piece of art in any form that I have ever seen in my life. Ben Brantley of the New York Times urges people to mortgage their houses and lease their children to acquire tickets to it, which at this point you'd pretty much have to. Anything that inspires this kind of lunatic devotion will also inspire a backlash, in this case, accusations of historical inaccuracies and whitewashing. We employ that last term with conscious irony, in view of the show's casting of Black, Hispanic, and Asian actors in the roles of the notoriously dead white founding fathers. Hamilton's America is meritocratic and propositionally colorblind, which is a vision that many find inspiring and some find disingenuous. Hamilton's soundtrack is made up mostly of rap and hip-hop, which is a sound that many find listenable and some find intolerable. Here to discuss the merits and demerits of this show are First Things assistant editor Alexi Sargent, who is a Hamilton enthusiast and author of An Appreciation of Hamilton, which we've just published at firstthings.com, and junior fellow Connor Grubaugh, who's a Hamilton skeptic. This conversation will take the form of a rap battle. No, just kidding. Alexi, let's start with you. What would you like everyone to know about Hamilton?
I was speaking with First Things contributing writer David Bentley Hart a little while ago, and he shared with me that he'd just emerged from a sort of hibernation to view the political and pop cultural landscape afresh. And he was surprised and initially believed it to be a joke when someone told him Donald Trump was the Republican frontrunner. And I said, that's all right, there's also good news, because a hip-hop musical about Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton is becoming the most acclaimed Broadway show of this generation. David Bentley Hart greeted this news with a noncommittal shrug, and so I proceeded to make the hard sell for the musical Hamilton, because I believe anyone who cares about America should be a fan of Hamilton. Hamilton tells the story of the Founding Fathers in a way that makes them cool again, and it more importantly positions politics downstream of character and character downstream of marriage and family. As I argue in my piece, the moral heart of Hamilton is his story of temptation and sin and forgiveness that plays out in the second act of the musical. We're warned by George Washington in this story that winning is easy, son, governing's harder. And Hamilton finds that true both in his political life and in his personal life. He has an affair with a married woman, he is exposed to blackmail, and then he lays the whole story of his transgression out in the open to clear himself of charges of financial wrongdoing. But of course, by publishing this pamphlet, he destroys his family. His relationship with his wife is understandably shattered by the revelations of his long adultery. This is the first sex scandal in American political history, and the show portrays Hamilton's participation in it as a profound moral failing. And then we have a show-stopping number during the second act called It's Quiet Uptown, where the ineffability of grace is channeled through Eliza Hamilton, Hamilton's wife, who, through reasons that we and perhaps she can't fully understand, makes the hard decision to forgive her repentant and devastated husband and try to rebuild their family in the wake of this betrayal and this tragedy.
Connor, you're a bit more skeptical of Hamilton and its sudden popularity. What are your concerns?
So when I first heard about Hamilton, the musical, through
one of these innumerable 3,000-word think pieces that the show has generated. I was struck first and foremost by what a great historiographical coup had just occurred in our political landscape. For really the entirety of American history, Thomas Jefferson was the darling of the left. He was an egalitarian. He believed in quiet pastoral virtues. He was the author of the Declaration, sort of the agnostic Enlightenment version of the American founding. It sprung from Jefferson, and it was amenable with progressivism. And likewise, for centuries, Hamilton was the man of the right, who believed in free trade, free markets, and the standardized weights and measures that sustain those. He started the first national bank, which didn't last too long. But he's known and has been known throughout American history as the man of the markets.
He's the patron saint of Wall Street.
Exactly. But this musical changes all of that. Suddenly, Hamilton is attracting, as you mentioned, Michelle Obama and the president. New York Times writers have been all over this musical from the beginning. And so I wanted to know why. You know, what suddenly made Hamilton attractive to the American left? And unfortunately, I think the only possible answer is that Lin-Manuel Miranda, drawing on this biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow, managed to fit the historical figure, Alexander Hamilton, into the contemporary categories of identity politics, into our sort of progressive mores in a way that revised his meaning in the American Revolution, that changed the story of what the American Revolution and Hamilton's role in it was all about in a way that made him something we can stomach today.
Right. And so what exactly are the revisions that have been made to his legacy and his persona that make him so available to the multicultural left?
Yeah. So first, I should be clear, there are, you know, a few facts of Hamilton's life that do lend themselves to this sort of narrative. You know, he was born outside of the 13 colonies to, as far as we know, by his accounts, a poor family born out of wedlock, and immigrated to the United States with the ambition to rise to the top, and did so with remarkable success. But politically, Hamilton was by no means a 21st century progressive. For much of American history, people looked on his political thought with skepticism, wondering whether he was a monarchist all along. At least he was a reactionary sort of classical Republican in the Roman tradition. And he would have been insulted, really, I think, that today we would judge his actions and his ideas not on their own merit, but on the degree to which they flatter our contemporary moral ideologies.
Yeah, so there are these issues of historical accuracy. There are also, I think, questions about you know, just how progressive is the racial progressivism of this musical. So you have Hamilton delivering great applause lines like, "Immigrants, we get the job done," you know, and we can understand why that sort of pro-immigrant sentiment is very appealing to a lot of people right now at a time of great racial tension. Similarly, to visualize all the founding fathers as minority men, you know, that also is sort of an inspiring vision for a lot of people. But a question that I had when I just heard about the concept of this multiracial casting was the following. I thought, who then are the actors who are going to portray actual people of color at the time of the revolution? Say, the slaves who were owned by the founding fathers. Are the slaves going to have the same complexions as their masters, or are the slaves going to be white, or what? And it turns out this never becomes an issue because people of color are simply not represented on stage, with maybe one slight exception. I'm not exactly clear. I know they're spoken about, they're in the lyrics at some points, but they don't appear, and this seems to me very strange. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, but it does seem strange to me that this show, which is celebrated as racially progressive, kind of acquires that cachet, partly by means of this gimmick of multiracial casting, which then requires it to render actual, literal, historical people of color actually invisible. So let's pretend for a little while that George Washington was a black man. And in order to do that, let's not think about the fact that he was a slave owner. I mean, this seems to me a very odd kind of thing to regard as racially progressive. But go ahead, Alexi.
One note on the staging. The ensemble does, in fact, portray slaves at Monticello at an important point in Thomas Jefferson's introductory number in the show. Okay. So the same actors that are playing members of Washington's cabinet or, you know, the group of people listening to Hamilton give speeches in favor of the revolution or the soldiers fighting on the British or the American sides also become the enslaved people in that moment. So it's not so much that actual Americans of color are totally erased in Hamilton, though you are hitting on a critique from the left I've heard some people make. But it's more that through the theatrical device of doubling, this cast, which is made up of persons of color, are playing people of all complexions in the story of America's founding. The statement being made is that America's founding belongs to all Americans, and that all of us, regardless of race nowadays, are part of this country that the founding fathers created and can claim what is best in that legacy.
Right. So I would agree with Alexi that really the goal of the musical, aside from telling the engaging life story of Alexander Hamilton, is to rehabilitate the American Revolution and the founding of the country for a generation that has looked on it with suspicion for some time. You know, why they're told that slavery and racism fundamentally tainted the compromises that led to the Constitution, or were told that the revolution was really just a merchant bourgeoisie looking after its own interests. And Hamilton quite effectively sort of brings our attention back to a degree to the questions that the founders themselves may have been more interested in, questions of freedom and identity, meaning and purpose in a political community. But the way in which that's done is concerning to me. I think it's clearest in the way that Lin-Manuel Miranda treats Jefferson as opposed to the way he treats Washington. Washington was also a slave owner. And neither Jefferson nor Washington were particularly vehement opponents of their fellow Southerners when it came to the question of slavery and its being written into the Constitution. But of the two, Jefferson was actually more vocal about some of his moral discomforts with the institution of slavery. And yet, in the musical, it's Jefferson who's really excoriated for this vice, and Washington is presented, as he really always has been, the founder of his country, first in the hearts of his countrymen. So what this tells me is, again, we're not really interested in encountering the founding of the country again on its own terms. We're interested in using it to promote our own current political interests. As much as I disagree with most of what Voltaire had to say, he was a progressive too. And so it's particularly telling that he knew when you take on this progressive worldview, what happens is history becomes a pack of tricks we play in the dead. And that's what I think is what's happened here.
Can we talk about the music just for a moment? I haven't heard the whole soundtrack. I've heard only My Shot, which is, I think, one of the signature songs.
Absolutely.
I felt that it was the most percussive and least tuneful thing that I had heard since the jackhammer left the street in front of my building. can someone defend music in Hamilton, which everyone else in the world seems to adore, but it's not something, I don't get it.
Oh, the music's very multifaceted in the show. If My Shot wasn't to your taste, you might prefer King George's ballads, which are not rap, but a kind of soulful British invasion tunes of him singing to the American colonies as if they are a lover that has left him, but he tells them, you'll be back. There's a lot of different influences in the show, right? Lin-Manuel Miranda grew up not only as a fan of hip-hop, but as a devotee of musical theater. So you can see kind of lyrical and musical references to South Pacific, Parade, many Sondheim musicals all woven through the show. I think that two of my favorite numbers are the incredibly fast-paced Lafayette rap, Guns and Ships, which Leah Labresco ran the numbers for 538 to discover it was the fastest set of lyrics ever put on stage, you know, beating out Gilbert and Sullivan patter songs by a lot. And then the other number that I'm a big fan of is It's Quiet Uptown, even though it causes you to cry every time you listen to it.
So I think, Julia, you're right that the choice of music, musical genre here, is important. And I don't think that Miranda would have been able to really communicate this revisionist telling of the revolution if he'd chosen some other kind of music. Hip-hop and rap lend themselves to this sort of build-up of passion as the beat reaches a climax, the tension builds, and suddenly everything sort of bursts, particularly in this track, the opening track that you mentioned, My Shot. Back to that chorus, I'm not going to give up my shot, not going to give away my shot.
I'm not throwing away my shot.
Throwing away my shot. Whatever you want to do with your shot, he's holding on to it. It's about taking something that you're entitled to or that is one's own, but which society is claiming for itself or is opposing. It reminded me, actually, of a great conversation between Huey Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party, and Bill Buckley on Firing Line back in the 1960s, in which, in a sort of reversal of roles at the opening of the segment, Newton asked Buckley whether he would have supported the American Revolution if he had been alive at the time that it transpired. And Buckley's answer was surprising to me and I think to Newton as well, which was maybe. Because Buckley said that he fundamentally opposes revolutions and can only support them if they're humane, if they are successful or promise to be successful. They have widespread popular support. In other words, he gave reasons for supporting or opposing a revolution and admitted that he wasn't entirely sure whether the American Revolution was one he could support. But that's not how Newton understood the word revolution. He understood revolution to be something which is a response to one's passionate feeling that one is being oppressed by an external authority. And that's the sort of story of revolution that is being told in Hamilton. That somebody like Hamilton, growing up poor and on the outside, could feel this ambition to rise above it all and could do it. And that's what's worth telling for Miranda about the American Revolution. But I think the founders understood the American Revolution in profoundly different terms. They gave reasons for what they believed and for what they did. They said things like no taxation without representation, or they said we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And these are reasons that we can debate, of course, and ought to. There are even reasons that we can oppose, but passion, whether it's the passion of Hamilton or the passion of, you know, Huey Newton, the Black Panther, is not something that we can oppose or debate. Just like we can't talk about identity politics today in rational terms. Miranda's taking away the American Revolution as an object of debate and public discourse for us.
Connor, you mentioned the reasons that the Founding Fathers had for undertaking this revolution. Their reasons were always, or fundamentally, with reference to the Creator, who creates men equal and endows them all with inalienable rights. And it's been pointed out by Richard Samuelson in the Claremont Review of Books that the Creator is absent from the musical Hamilton. Creation in the musical is revolutionary action in the political sphere. There doesn't seem to be anything above, anything transcendent of political action, with the limited exception of, you know, a cruciform gesture when somebody's son dies. But rights, the rights of men, seem to derive in the musical from the creative work of political leaders, not from nature and nature's God. And Samuelson goes on to point out that this seems consistent with what we can divine about Miranda's own politics. He's a liberal. He hangs out with the Obamas and Clintons. Anyway, this seems to be an example of a way in which the musical is informed by a specific contemporary politics, and to that extent may falsify the founding in a specifically liberal direction, fair or unfair.
I'll call it semi-fair.
Okay.
I think that impulse to ground rights mostly in political action is part of what's going on. I think it's responding to some of the deist tendencies in the founders. Only some members, you know, of the group we call the Founding Fathers were committed to a personal God. Perhaps that deist streak comes through in the way, you know, the founding documents are presented in the musical, where we get, you know, lyrics like, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm a compel him to include women in the sequel," which Hamilton's sister-in-law, Angelica, raps at one point, which does suggest that, you know, human action is what creates this equality. So a partial hit there, though I think part of what's going on is about the deism present in America's founding to begin with. I wish there were more language about the Creator, both in Hamilton and in the writings of the Founding Fathers.
So I see Hamilton really as trying to stem the tide of the sort of universal suspicion, particularly as applied to history, that is now virulent in American public discourse. And that suspicion is in many ways drawing on the forms of critical thinking and theory that are now taught in our university. These are very powerful ideas, but the problem with them is they are only critical, as they're named, not constructive. And so what's happened to the country's relationship with its own past recently is that there really are no heroes anymore, and there are no believable foundations for moral values or for even an abstract historical narrative that we could tell about ourselves and how we are the way we are today. And this is a huge problem, as you point out, with this absence of a creator. If we can't find a firmer foundation for this moral consensus that sustains our public discourse, these first principles of our public conversation, then we'll be subsumed into the categories of identity politics, which can't communicate with each other, which are sort of trapped in their own worlds. So the founders knew that they needed to give this rational foundation, they needed to give a reason for the type of republic, the type of state that they had created. And they found that in the Creator. They found that this was something, this notion of something beyond us was so universally believed in that it could sustain our public discourse for centuries. And they were right about that. But today, we're searching for a new foundation. Hamilton's searching for a new foundation. But my worry is that we're searching in all the wrong places, that Hamilton hasn't really uncovered any new source of broad public moral consensus that will allow us to reform our American identity for a tumultuous future.
I think just the fact that you're considering a musical as a candidate for uncovering broad moral consensus shows that it's transcended what we usually ask of our entertainment.
Alexei, are there any more fabulous lyrics from the musical that you would like to recite before we sign off?
At my second date with my now fiance, we hosted a listen-through of the whole of Hamilton the musical, and at intermission we had a competition to see who could do their best job rapping the fastest passage in the show, the Marquis de Lafayette's Guns and Ships rap. And so I competed in that competition and did not take home the gold, but I'm willing to give it another try right now for the benefit of First Things podcast listeners. Shall I go ahead?
Please do.
All right. Everybody give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman, Lafayette. I'm taking this horse by the reins, making redcoats redder with bloodstains. Lafayette, never gonna stop until I make him drop brick and mutton, scatter the remains. I'm Lafayette, watch me engaging him, enraging him, escaping him. I'm Lafayette, I go to France for more funds. Lafayette, I come back with more guns and ships. And so the balance shifts. We rendezvous with Rochambeau, consolidate their gifts. We can end this war at Yorktown, cut some off by sea. But for this to succeed, there's someone else we need. I know, Hamilton, sir, he knows what to do in a trench. He's intuitive and fluent in French. I mean, Hamilton, what's he gonna do on the bench? I mean, he's gonna have to use eventually. Hamilton, no one has more resilience or matches my practical tactical brilliance. Hamilton, you wanna fight for your land back? Hamilton, you need your right-hand man back. Yeah, yeah, gotta get your right-hand man back. I mean, you better put some thought into the letter, but the sooner the better to get your right-hand man back.
Well, we have to ask for the rights to that.
I think it's covered by fair use.
Covered by fair use.
No,
all right.
That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno, Matthew Schmitz, Alexei Sargent, and Connor Grubaugh. Thanks to the Marquis de Lafayette for his lyrical stylings. And thank you, listeners.